If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. Michelle Kingdom is a Californian embroidery artist who creates modern, nostalgic vignettes that tell stories of light and dark with beauty and style. This is the second part of our needle exchange, and in this episode, we dive into Michelle's processes some more. But also because, and I love it when this happens, because Michelle listens to the podcast, she knew what was coming. And so we have a good old chinwag about her favourite books, films, types of music, and indeed what it is to have a favourite and what that actually means. We also have a good explore about Michelle's fact that not a lot of people know about her. But honestly, such a pleasurable conversation. Michelle, she's so full of beans. We recorded this conversation at 6 o'clock in the morning, her time, and she was well up for it. And I think it just, there's a contrast that I admire about Michelle between the person that she is and how full of energy she is, and then the quiet pace of her work, where there's an almost haunting quality to them. She chooses muted colours, she chooses muted threads, she chooses classic design, her use of plants, her use of fashion, the way she makes these pieces so they look like they're from a bygone era and yet sometimes they reflect very modern concerns. It's an absolute pleasure talking to Michelle. Hopefully I'll get her back on again. As I was doing the show, I wrote down Michelle Kingdom, the return, in the show notes, so I think that's definitely something that I will have to follow up with, and I'm sure you will enjoy her work. Obviously, seek her out on the internet if you don't already know who she is and prepare to be blown away. But here she is, Michelle Kingdom. I hope you enjoy the show. Plants. Plants are a thing throughout your work and a deliberate thing. Are they real plants or do you just make plants up?
It's both.
Right.
A lot of times part of the fun of making this work is symbolism for me. So for many, many pieces, the flower is chosen for its historical symbolism. You know, somebody might not be able to even recognize that kind of flower. If it's very small, it could be really hard. But I'm front loading the work with that for me.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of like, you know, it's buried in there. Sometimes it is recognizable. It's not essential, hopefully. But, you know, for my story, they all, you know, sort of have some purpose. Sometimes it'll be merely for like a more decorative kind of a framework. So I can't say it's 100%. But usually most pieces, you know, I try to really think about why I'm putting in everything I'm putting in.
Mm-hmm. Can you give me like your top three Michelle Kingdom codes? If you see this plant on my Instagram, here's roughly what I'm telling you.
You know, I would have to probably think about that because I don't have like favorites. Usually each piece, you know, I might start something along the way and then I'm researching something. Like the piece I had just finished, it's a few figures and they're sitting in a pond and there's water lilies, you know, and I didn't start out thinking about what type they were going to be, but in my mind it turned into a whole different thing. I did some research about symbolism of like the blue lotus and, you know, its history in ancient Egypt and, you know, just all of the stories. I love Greek mythology, so lots of things I try to pull from that just for myself. And just, you know, to me, those figures and the plants became a rhizome underneath that you can't see, where, you know, there is no center. They're all offshoots of the same thing, and they're all going to keep growing. They're all coming off the sides, you know. So that came later in the stitching and made it a more complete piece in my brain.
Interesting.
So that's like that's a nice development that usually happens along the way, the process where you start something, you have some intention about it, you have a certain idea of maybe how you want it to look, you keep going as you're stitching, and then it crystallizes along the way for you. I mean, it might be something else for the viewer. I am not going to control what the viewer thinks, and I don't want to control. Sometimes people are like, you know, what's the story behind blah, 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 and I get it, but, you know, it's not one story. It's not one story. And I sometimes don't want to share all of my particulars because I don't want to close the story for other people. They might see something completely different.
Yeah, that's interesting. But you're like the OG viewer. You're the first person who gets to see it. So you're the first person who gets to tell the story.
Right.
And also, I mean, your style of stitching does remind me of, like, it's like botanical illustration, isn't it? Those books that you get of flowers from the, I'm going to say 19th century because I don't know any better. But there's are those kind of references quite important? Do you kind of like upholding that kind of tradition?
Yeah, you know, I'm always kind of working from my gut. But yes, I love botanical illustrations. We have a wonderful museum here called the Huntington Gardens. It's the Huntington family, who was a big, rich family from years ago in this suburb called Pasadena. Anyway, it's his huge mansion and gardens, and it's beautiful. They have a library that has, you know, a Gutenberg Bible and all kinds of historical documents. But my favorite treasure there is they have a copy of John Audubon's book of his illustrations. And every time you go, they turn it to a different page. It's enormous. You know, I could just stand in front of there. It's beautiful. It's a dark room. It just glows, the clarity, you know, in a room filled with just type all around you. It's beautiful.
Yeah, I feel like some of those kind of books as well, and maybe this is a thing you appreciate the older you get, but, you know, like, they weren't there before. Like, a lot of these people who are doing these pictures, those pictures weren't there before. It's a bit like, I don't know, discovering the music of Queen. It's always been there, but imagine the first time you ever heard, I don't know, Bohemian Rhapsody or whatever, you know? It's like,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, these people, you know, that are, you know, basically discovering how this plant works. You know, what does it actually look like inside? You know, that's when people start taking art classes and they start actually drawing and looking at things. You know, there's a whole world of seeing that you realize, I've never really looked at things before until you really, really study them, which is, you know, part of what's fun as an artist about doing these old fashioned mediums where there's just a lot of time and handwork involved. It's like you really are walking the walk. You're not just like, you know, picking up something, you know, on the iPad, and which I love that too, but it's nice just having that depth of awareness of what came before, you know, how we got these colors, you know, how, where this fabric came from, where these threads came from, you know, how lucky we are that I can just go to the shop and get, you know, a DMC skein of cotton thread.
Yeah. No, I agree. And again, I seem to be referring back to lots of previous needle exchanges in this episode. This is great, though. But like, talking to Dr. Susan K. Williams about the history of color, you know, all of that stuff, like, when you actually get to understand it, it's just mind blown that, like, sorry, we don't do blue. You're like, right. What? Just doesn't really make any sense.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, going back to, you know, my interest just in archaeology and anthropology, just, you know, all the cultures and, you know, the time spent on dyeing red around the world and the bugs, you know, and how many bugs do you have to squash to get a decent amount of red, you know? I mean, it's,
you know, and how they were just like, oh, look, well, that's a little bit of red. What if I squash 5 bugs? Right, and then somebody read, Bill, I tell you what, let's do 5 million bugs. And see, it didn't stick. I know. I'm going to wee on it. Let's see if that makes it stick. Well, look at that. It made it stick. Yeah.
And then I wash it and it starts to fade.
Yeah. Oh, Bill, what if you wee on it this time instead of something? I wanted to ask you, there's a piece you did recently for a Gen X show.
Yes.
Which I thought was quite different because in some ways it was like a, deliberately retro. I don't know. Yes. It was almost, it's quite like an advert, wasn't it? It was a different yes. style for you, I would say.
Well, and back to my discussion of growing up in the 70s, that's exactly what I was thinking of
true,
in that piece.
Yeah.
But do you have a specific question about that before I
No, I just wanted to talk about it. Is it being a bit of an outlier, perhaps?
So that was for a show called Gen X, and it was a local other artist here in town that asked me to do a piece for the show. So I said, sure, I'll do it. And then I was just really thinking a lot about growing up in the 70s and all of the different things that I remembered and witnessed. So the piece is basically the cover of a Peachy folder for people that remember. Those are folders that we all used in school. It's sort of like a goldenrod yellow color.
Right.
And it had a very flat illustration line work of like a tennis player girl, some boys playing football, you know, it was all athletic stuff. And then you would open it up and you would have your folder and you would write, you know, the names of your favorite bands, you know, Led Zeppelin, Doodling, whatever.
Yeah, yeah, boyfriend names.
Yeah. So I decided to make mine about the crazy warped female images that I grew up with. So the top figure I used from a made-for-TV movie with the grown-up Jan Brady from the Brady Bunch diary. Oh, no, maybe she wasn't in this. Maybe it was a different one. But basically, it was Diary of a Teenage Hitchhiker. We had lots of these cautionary tales where they, okay. you know, completely sexualized young girls.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's out there with her hot pants hitchhiking on the road. And, of course, you know, the mass murderer was going to be finding her. and then the second illustration was the classic scene from Charlie's Angels with, I think it was called Angels on the Run. And it was the three of them in, like, their blue denim prison work suits. They were undercover in the prisons, escaping through the swamps.
Strong hair game, nonetheless.
Strong feathered hair. At the bottom, the largest figure was the, I hesitate to use the word iconic, but it was picture of Patty Hearst when she was held hostage and became Tanya and was holding up a bank. And I say that it became an iconic image for us, but it was, of course, an awful, horrible, traumatic thing that they blamed on her and all of these things. So, you know, I'm loading it up with all of these. To me, it all looks like it was fun 70s, you know, pop culture-y kinds of things. But when you actually look at what are these images, these are all horrific, awful things that I still carry with me as a woman all the time, because these were sort of the expectations, you know, kind of goes back to Great Gatsby, you know, at the end, Daisy's like, you know, I hope my daughter's beautiful, beautiful and dumb, because, you know, that's the only thing a girl should be, that kind of a thing. But when I did put that piece on social media, it got a lot of great positive reactions from people. But one woman was really didn't really understand my intent. And she was like, how dare you put this picture of Patty Hearst up? She was, you know, a victim and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and I get she didn't know where I was coming from. So I wrote her back and I said, you know, I completely agree with you. That's exactly why I'm making this piece. I'm making this piece. So I hope that we can see, look at this. This was Gen X.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Love that. I also love the fact that, as you said, classic, if you'll permit me, classic Michelle Kingdom move is, it looks nice, it's really bad.
Right. It's like it's all really bad. I mean, not always.
No.
You know, not everything has a really dark side, but life is kind of tinged all around, right?
Mm.
With beauty and darkness. It just is. And especially, I think, work that we find meaningful has all of those bits. I feel like most of it wouldn't be true if it's just like an endlessly beautiful, you know, flowery something. It's kind of, it doesn't stick with us.
Yeah, because that's not what life does, isn't it? Like, it saddens me in some ways when I look at my girls and I think how much joy they get out of, I don't know, a plate full of pasta or whatever. And then I think, what the bloody hell happened to me? You know, but that is kind of life, isn't it? Life is light and dark. And if it wasn't one or the other, we wouldn't appreciate the way it was.
Yeah.
Reasonable. So now you're doing a piece of work that is going to be in a self-portrait show. And that feels like a different departure.
Yeah. So, you know, I used to do self-portraits, of course, back in art school. But yeah, I have like zero interest in portraiture, period. I have zero interest in a likeness, and really no interest in a self-portrait of me. But a few weeks ago, I got a nice email from the curator at Forest Lawn. And if anybody doesn't know, that's a very large cemetery here in Los Angeles where many people, it's been there a long time. There's a few locations, you know, like Walt Disney is there. There's a lot of celebrities there. Anyway, it's kind of got a bit of a cult status just as a cemetery. And I'm kind of a fan of, we could talk about funerary art and back to the Fayum mummies and, you know, I mean, on and on and on. But anyway, they have a museum at their Glendale location. And the curator from that museum, and it's a regular museum. It's not about, you know, religious work. It's not about funerary work. It's just a museum there. And they have a lot of interesting shows. So he contacted me about it saying, you know, would I be interested? And I was like, Forest Lawn? Yeah, I'm totally interested, even though I don't have a self-portrait and I have no interest in one. But for you, I will make one if you want me to. And he said, yeah. So I'm excited. I'm going to actually have a little behind-the-scenes tour next month what they have there. So I'm really, really excited about that.
Yeah. Is there a risk that the process of stitching, the way that you stitch and the things that you stitch, stitching yourself might unearth some demons or possibly, you know?
I don't think it'll unearth demons, but it's definitely going to be, it's going to be a little bit larger than I would be normally comfortable working, but I know they want like a certain size for the show. I'm still not sure how I'm going to execute it yet at all. I'm not even sure of the ground fabric yet. So I'm going to tackle that this weekend and start really thinking about it.
I don't believe that you'll be able to just do, here's Michelle Kingdom's face. I don't like, it can't be that, can it? There's got to be a story behind it that makes us uneasy.
Well, The sketch that I picked, first of all, it was actually based on a photo from a few years ago when I was stitching at my parents' house. I don't know if it was my daughter or my mom took a photo of me from behind, and I'm stitching a different piece. So it's a picture of like peering over my shoulder. So in the sketch, what I'm going to do is the piece that I'm stitching is going to be me instead of the other piece. And then I'm going to add another one that's sort of like the iPad with the picture of me. So it'll be like a double-double. It's a bit of a reference to the Norman Rockwell, you know, selfie within a selfie kind of thing. So the photo I'm actually working from of myself, too, it's hard to even tell it's me. So I'm not too concerned, like, is it going to look like me or not? I'm still trying to figure out if those two will be exactly the same. You know, the picture from the larger actual picture that's doing the action from the back, will actually probably most likely be the most that's me because I don't know if you can tell, but I stopped dyeing my hair for, you know, covering grays in COVID. So it'll be lots of gray. So the rest might not. So I'll sort of be looking back into myself, into my earlier self. And then, you know, the person kind of looking in is going to be, you know, where I am currently.
What's that? A picture of Dorian Gray. Is that a thing? Is it something like
that? Yeah.
Now, like that portrait that's eternally young up in someone's loft or whatever it is, you know, it's probably some kind of, I was thinking for some reason of like, what if like one of the portraits was black and white and the other one's color or something?
I was thinking about line work. I'm not sure. They might both be in color, but the one that's actually stitched, you know, there's also going to be lots of needles because the picture I'm actually holding up a needle like this. People that are listening can't see, but I'm basically trying to look through the needle's eye in the picture that I'm doing of myself. That's why it's a little warped. So everyone will have that needle, but the final figure with the gray hair that we'll be stitching will be pulling up the thread. So most likely there'll be thread coming out of my mouth, but we'll see.
But I mean, you said it exists in your brain. So at some point it's bound to come out of your mouth. It all seems very natural. Another thing I wanted to explore was the fact that your work does appear on quite a few book covers these days, which is wonderful.
Yeah, it's so wonderful. I'm so grateful that people are interested and have asked. What can I say? That's been great.
Yeah, and it lends itself to poetry. There seem to be a lot of poetry books as well, which I think is quite nice. It's a nice fit.
Yeah, very nice. You know, one of the first book covers that somebody had contacted me about years ago was actually from a doctor. And I can't remember if they were a neurologist or a psychiatrist, but basically it was talking about identity and sort of mental health issues. And I really appreciated that, you know, somebody in the medical world saw something that could kind of speak to the subject. And I was really proud that it was used for that. It was like a, you know, most of these things, you may get paid. It's not usually a lot. Sometimes you don't, you know, if you get something through a big publisher, yeah, that's a different deal when it's like a novel. But it's nice if it's, you know, almost free work, but it's kind of going to something that you feel like is a worthy thing for study.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But that's where I think, to be honest, your work on poetry books is also a worthy combination, because I think it provides that disconnect from reality yet remains grounded within reality.
Yeah, and there have been really wonderful authors and poets that have reached out to me, and I really appreciate, you know, there have been a few, and they're on my website if anybody's interested in reading them, but they are really delightful books.
Right. Let's do the hard stuff now, because I see the sun coming up behind you, so that's...
I know, look at this, sun in Burbank.
Nice. Happy days, happy days. We've got Overcasting Crew. That's probably one of my chapters in my memoir when eventually we get here. Do you have a favorite band / album?
Okay, so I had told you before we kind of came on, and you know, we kind of know that you're going to be asking a few questions, and anyone who hears the podcast knows it always comes to the favorites part. So you know, you think about this as you're driving in your car, and you're like, How am I going to sum up myself, right, in like one thing? The honest answer is, currently, there's not really one favorite, and I'm honestly not listening to a lot of music right now. I do listen to some, which I think actually there's a few deep dives that I thought we could take. One, just the idea of favorites. Are the listeners interested in current favorites, just to have like a take the temperature of where are you right now? Are you interested for finding something new and cool? Are you interested in the journey of what were your favorites that made you? So there's a lot of different ways to go. But the short version is, the overarching artist for me is always Elliott Smith.
Okay.
Yeah. I will always, even if I'm not always listening, it's like, that voice is assimilated in my head, which is part of what I loved when I first heard him. It was just like, you know, all the static just kind of tuned in, and you're like, the clarity happened. Anyway, but there's plenty of other wonderful, so many amazing musicians. I mean, you know, Beatles, Velvet Underground. I love the Go-Betweens. Andy Schaaf, who's a newer Canadian artist. You know, I like his work. I like Wet Leg. I think maybe like my favorite single song is probably Hey Ya by Outkast. Okay. You know, I mean, so, you know, overall.
see, I like this, because I know, like, we don't... don't need to analyze it too much, but it is interesting, because I think sometimes people will be like, the last good one I heard or whatever, or for some people that, like, I couldn't answer that question, because it depends what day of the week it is and how much crap I've had to put up with my children, quite frankly, as to what kind of album I want to listen to.
But I mean, it's very much based on your mood. But I think the other interesting topic about this is, why are so few of us listening to music anymore, especially albums, which of course we know, streaming and all of those things, but it's definitely different than it used to be, when you would have that precious album and you would listen to it over and over and over, or you'd get the mixtapes and people would make them for you, and you know, they were like love letters. It's, I mean, maybe for, you know, my daughter and her generation, they're doing that through their Spotify playlists, I guess, but it just doesn't feel the same for me.
And so what are you spending your time listening to then?
So I listen to podcasts now, like yours.
Thank you very much.
Most of my stitching time is spent listening to nothing. I actually find it very hard to listen to music. I don't know why. I feel like I'm walking in somebody else's daydream if I'm listening to music. And I'm trying to focus on my crazy daydream that I'm stitching. When it's like news and podcasts, for some reason it's just like chatter that I am paying attention, but I'm still able to be in my dream world. So that's really what I listen to. So if you're interested in those podcasts, I can tell you which ones I like.
Go on. I'll write them down.
The Needle Exchange.
Thanks very much. That's I'm definitely making a snippet out of that for social.
But I kind of have like a weekly, you know, because of the political chaos of the world, there's one here called Sisters-in-Law that I listen to every weekend, and it kind of, you know, sums up a lot of things that have happened. I love, and I don't know if this is like a complete geeky thing for people in the UK, but I love the Infinite Monkey Cage.
Okay. Oh, yeah, that's that science-y one, isn't it? With
I love it. Is it Robin Ince? I love scientists.
Yeah.
I love them. I mean, it's scientists and comedians, and it's smart, and it's funny, and...
And you get an English accent, which obviously rubs even more into it for you guys, right?
You know, well, my husband is English. I don't know if you know
okay.
that.
Okay.
Yeah, so he's been here since 1999, but he is from Didcot in Oxfordshire, but as an adult was in London. So I get to hear plenty of the English accent, but you know, he, of course... thinks about home a lot. So we do have a lot of BBC programming here. We're watching a lot of Portrait Artists of the Year on TV at night, which is really fun. Nice. I love watching anybody's process. It's really delightful. I also love The Moth.
Oh, yeah.
Which is all storytelling.
Yeah,
and
really good.
It'll make me cry at the drop of a hat. Everyone is so honest and wonderful. And This American Life. Mm-hmm. And Katie Hessel, the great women artists. I know when you talk to Orly Hogan, she and I are internet friends and we had talked about it. And she is such a wonderful young art historian that is really talking about women in art and rewriting women in art. And she's doing it in a way that is exuberant and delightful. She's so wonderful. And it's just great. Everyone should really listen to it. It's delightful if you like fine art.
Yeah. Have you heard So What? Like Isabella Rosner?
Oh, yes. I love Isabella Rosner. And she's, I think, an LA native too, right?
Well, exactly. That's what I mean. She almost sounds exactly like you, but she'll be talking about like frog purses from the 1700s or something.
Oh, and I listened to that, and I think I later had to Google that one too. So I had to see the little frog purse. But yes, no, I love her. She's been kind of on hiatus. I think it maybe just started again. So I need to get clued back into that one.
Yeah, she's too busy being a curator at the Royal School of Needlework, isn't she?
You
like
go,
la-di-da.
Right on.
Honestly, so good. Right? But that's what I love, you know, to like you were saying with Katie, like I love Isabella's voice because it's not the voice you would expect for the stuff that she's talking about. And so therefore it just re-engages.
Yes, yeah, which like actually kind of echoes the whole reason for loving fiber arts and textile arts. It's not the voice we have been told is the masterful male macho blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
It might come out of a young woman.
It could, yeah. And I'm not really allowed to talk about things coming out of young women, but no, I completely agree.
Don't go there, Jamie.
Thank you. Do you have a favorite book?
So once again, like all the great books in history, blah, 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 blah. But the one that I use the most for my work is The Waves by Virginia Woolf.
Okay.
I love all of Virginia Woolf's every single thing. I love Emily Dickinson and her poetry. I mean, such geniuses. I love Carson McCullers, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, Member of the Wedding, lots of short stories. I do love Tolstoy. I know you had somebody on a podcast. Was it Diane?
Yeah. And she's working away through it on audio. Yeah.
Yes. I haven't listened to audiobooks, and maybe I should try to tackle that. But actually reading Anna Karenina is so... It's just every sentence is enlightening. I don't know how he did it. I don't know how he did it. And a very depressing book of his, too, that is wonderful is The Death of Ivan Illich, just on a complete flip side. I mean, that's the other thing. All the Russians, they're all depressing, too. But they're beautiful and depressing.
Boy, can they wield those words.
I am a huge fan of fairy tales.
Okay.
And one of my dream future projects, saying this as someone who's like, I have no future projects in mind. I'm going to completely contradict myself, as one does. I love Hans Christian Andersen.
Okay.
But they are all cautionary tales. There are no fairy tales. They are all dark. But one day I would love to illustrate them.
Yes, that is a no-brainer. That really is, yeah. There's, I mean, my Mary's mother, so my mother-in-law has got quite a few fairy tale books back at her house. And when we read them to the children and we're like, and this girl died in the cold. And these children died inside a mountain. And we're just like, oh my God.
Died. The little matchstick girl, she held up the match and just died. And she saw her grandmother before she went off to her, you know.
Yeah.
I mean,
what is it? The Lonely Giant. Yeah.
The Little Mermaid, you know. She sold her voice for a guy and he didn't love her and she turned into sea foam and her only, you know, salvation at the end was getting a soul.
Oh man alive. We need to, if there are any publishing companies, just do a run of books, get Michelle to do the covers. It'll all make perfect sense.
I mean, right?
Yeah.
We could do the feminist version of Hans Christian Andersen.
I love it. That's very good. Film/TV programs. Films.
These are all so hard, Jamie. So, of course, there's like a bazillion favorites and blah, blah, blah. Okay, but two of the fun-loving ones, I'll say. Harold and Maude.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Maude is sort of the goal. And anyone who hasn't seen that film, it's a 70s movie, but it's a quirky one with a love story between, you know, I don't know, an 18-year-old and an 80-year-old woman. And she's completely delightful and living every moment. And he's depressed and wants to kill himself. It's just a great little movie. She's kind of the goal, and I have to say I probably feel further away from her the older I get, sadly. But
there's like a spectrum, whether you're a bit more Harold today or a bit more Maude today.
But it's a wonderful film to see, especially every few years, and kind of recalibrate and remember, you know, that's something to aim for in life. I also love I Love You, Alice B. Toklas.
Okay.
Peter Sellers. It was a 60s film. It's very quirky, where he's like an uptight lawyer and he meets this hippie chick, and she's the one that played Furniture from Soylent Green, which I also love, you know, back to the 70s, you know, like chaos kind of movies and end of the world stuff. Has a great Harper's Bazaar soundtrack to that one too, but it's just very funny. Very funny.
I like that. I've written that down. I wasn't aware of that. You thought I should be contractually obliged. Yeah, definitely.
But those are the quirky ones, you know. Another one that's not a great movie, but actually has a huge influence on, I realize, my work, is a really, really, really like B film from the 1950s called Attack of the Puppet People. And it's the story of a doll maker who gets these secretaries and they disappear. Because he shrinks them and turns them into dolls on a shelf.
Yeah, I can think of about four pieces of yours. Yeah, honestly, isn't it? You're just like, wow.
Are this.
Was there a moment when you went, oh my God, all of my figures are from this film?
Yeah, you know how you see things as a child and you have like a vague recollection and then you're like, I gotta find that as an adult. Mm. And then you find it and you put it on. You're like, oh my God, I am doing this over and over.
Oh, that's amazing. That's probably it, isn't it? You're like, if you'd not watched that film, you'd have been happy-go-lucky painting some things,
maybe
some flowers and trees with no darkness whatsoever.
Very good. Right?
Happy days.
A whole other person.
Okay, here's the big one then. An interesting fact that not a lot of people know about Michelle Kingdom.
So some people might know this, but of course, most people know absolutely nothing about me. So probably anything would be something nobody knows.
Yeah.
But I am a full-time preschool teacher. And after we're done in 15 minutes, I'm going to go off to my job and teach, you know, 2 to 5 year olds so many important things about the world. I love early childhood education. I don't consider it like my day job. I feel like I have 2 careers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an early childhood educator. I love doing that. I want to keep doing that. I'm an artist. I love doing that, and I want to keep doing that. It's not something where I'm trying to build up my work so I can get rid of my day job. I want to do both.
Mm.
And they kind of equalize each other, because working with children is hard, but it's also wonderful and so rewarding. And for somebody who at their core might be a little bit pessimistic about everything in the world and how it's going to turn out, you know, children make you optimistic.
They do. Yeah, there's probably an interesting balance between those two worlds, actually, like one supporting the other. Because, yeah, like, so my youngest is now 5, and when I look back at the things that they go through between, like, 2 and 5, like, it's major, like toilets.
It's major.
Yeah.
It's all of it. But, I mean, just, first of all, the way that their brain works, and, you know, those are the magical thinking years, you know, where they are just seeing everything for the first time, and the way that they're taking it in, they're not having all that context and backstory. So, you know, even thinking about things that might seem like misbehavior, you know, a kid doing something that, you know, they shouldn't have done, they should have known better. They couldn't have known better. You know, they didn't know if they ripped out that plant that they were, you know, ruining somebody's garden. They were wanting to pick a beautiful flower. You know, they don't realize at that point, or they're building up a whole story about it. And I'm not, our job is to help teach them. But luckily I work for a very wonderful preschool surrounded by wonderful co-teachers, and we have a very hands-on developmental kind of a curriculum that we can tailor to every child. So we're not trying to beat them down into obediently, you know, listening to the teacher without questioning anything. We want them to be lifelong, curious, passionate learners.
Amazing. What tip have you got? You know, like when children, it's different, isn't it, when it's your own kid? But I mean, if children are driving you to the point of insanity, but you've got 15 of them and none of them are yours, what's your coping mechanism?
You know, the one common thing between stitching and teaching is patience. I think to be a really good teacher, you have to be really patient because they are going to do things that will drive you absolutely crazy. But it's also your frame of mind. When you come in knowing this is who they are, I need to teach them based on the way that they learn right now. I cannot expect them to learn the way I expect them to learn. First of all, they're not capable of that. They are only capable of being their true little selves. So the challenge for me and part of what makes my job exciting and fun is planning what I think would be engaging for children and doing it in a way that's meaningful to them. So, you know, anyone who has children knows, you know, you'll do thematic units. So, you know, if we're doing space, you know, I'm not just going to read them like space books. Yeah, there'll be some space books, but we're going to, you know, build our rockets. We're going to play games where we have to, you know, do very simple kind of calculations of how we do, you know, those moon shots. You know, we talked about how NASA, you know, got them to the moon and how they had to use math and have them love all these math and science things that they don't yet know those are really hard and they're supposed to, you know, be scared of them later to get back to Earth. You know, and they're ready for all of this. They're open to all of it. Everything holds the same weight for them. So, you know, they're an artist one day, they're a scientist the next day, they're a mathematician, they're, you know, just a social butterfly all the time.
I suppose you have these ideas about what the intention is, and then you just hope that towards the end there'll be some version of that intention, right?
Well, and you also, part of like an emergent curriculum, you know, people might hear that, but you kind of have to shift gears in action all the time. So you start delivering something you think they want to receive or in the way they will receive it, you can see that maybe it's not happening, and then you have to shift gears, either completely changing the lesson plan there on the spot or readjusting into something that they will hopefully be engaged with. You know, some kids are just not in it, and then we have a few teachers in the class, so maybe a kid needs to do something else at that time. You know, you can't force a child at that age to take something in, and that's when they'll start seemingly misbehave because their body is dysregulated. And, you know, there's so many things that we're learning about our sensory system and neurodivergent thinking. And, you know, there's so many different ways that we all learn. Every child is learning in a different way. Some are visual, some are auditory, some are, you know, using their body. So we try to make sure we're hitting all of those domains whenever we're delivering information.
Yeah, you get the outcome that you hoped for, roughly.
But usually, you know, as far as like a group time with like 15 children on the carpet where I'm imagining you're probably thinking, what do you do when they're all, you know, doing something they're not supposed to be? Luckily, kids really want to please. And not that we want to make them people pleasers, but they want to be part of the group. They want to learn. They want to do those things. So usually with experience, you really can find ways to get them engaged or to redirect them. A lot of it is redirecting too.
Has Bluey been a big help, or is that just for me?
So, actually, all of my children love Bluey, and I am one of the teachers who my daughter is, you know, now in college. So, I have never seen Bluey, and all of my co-teachers have kids that are little, so they're like, oh, you've got to see Bluey. Everyone loves Bluey. And I was like, no, I don't think. Anyway, one day, we have a big screen at our school, like an outdoor stage, and we did watch, I guess it was like that Bluey camping episode. It was cute.
Oh man,
it was very cute.
Okay, you need to watch the Sleepy Time episode. That's what I'm saying.
Maybe that was it.
The Sleepy Time one's got Host the Planets in it. It's guaranteed to make me cry literally every time I watch it.
I think I did see that one, and it was very good. It was very good. But I have to say, I also, there's so many shows that they talk about that I know the theme song. So to the kids, that's all we care about. You know, we're dancing like Paw Patrol, Paw Patrol. We are on the double, you know, all of those shows. So it's like, I've not usually seen them, but I know the characters.
Just get some PTSD over those theme tunes. Hey, Michelle, thanks for having a needle exchange with me.
Thank you, Jamie, for everything. So nice to see you and actually, like, talk.
Yeah, I know, man. I've written down in my notes, I've written Michelle Kingdom Returns.
Right.
That's when we'll really get under the surface of this stuff.
Oh, wow. Oh, my goodness. We're really... I wonder what we'll talk about then. What did we leave unturned?
We just put the world to right, won't we? Amazing. Thank you. Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange. That's needle.exchange with any thoughts, comments, or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needle exchange. See you next time.